Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Jody Barilaire from Morris James. I represent the appellants in this case, Reserve Development LLC and the Reserve Development Corporation. My argument will touch on four main points. First, Reserves has not been fully compensated for the losses it incurred, even if Esham is made to pay what he owes. Esham had a full and fair opportunity to raise this claim before Judge Stokes. Third, why res judicata should be applied in this case. And finally, the collateral source rule bars Esham's petition because his obligation to compensate Reserves for damages caused by his tort is separate and independent from severance payment on behalf of Bellavia. After trial in 2007, Judge Stokes entered a judgment for Reserves against Bellavia in the amount of almost $604,000. Even if Esham pays his tort liability of almost $152,000, Reserves will still not be paid all the money it was owed.
Excuse me, perhaps because I was involved in earlier versions or parts of this matter, I was aware that Reserves has not been fully compensated. What difference does that make?
I think it goes to, if there's any contention that Reserves here is seeking an excessive recovery or double payment, I think the fact that it hasn't been compensated for all that it is owed.
But isn't it double payment from this particular entity or person in the sense that the same items of debt or obligation, monetary obligation, are the ones that have already been paid and that have also been assigned to Esham?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so. I think the fact that the same numbers and invoices were used in both Vice Chancellor Parsons' calculation of severance obligation and Esham's calculation of his tort damages was a function of the way Judge Stokes calculated Esham's tort damages. Vice Chancellor Parsons used certain invoices and dollar amounts in calculating severance obligation, but Judge Stokes looked to familiar numbers, numbers that were familiar to both parties in calculating Esham's tort liability. He used those same invoices and dollar amounts to calculate the amount of damages that Esham owed personally under his tort liability. Those are separate and apart for what Severn owed and paid under its obligation. It was a method of calculating damages. There wasn't a double payment of the same exact damages. It was a method of calculation.
Well, but it was a method of calculation based upon the same the bond costs, and I forgot what the other one is, wasn't it?
It was. It was the numbers that Reserves paid out of pocket, so it was a number familiar to the parties. It was tied to...
And Reserves has been paid back that same amount through Sovereign, right?
It's been paid that same amount, yes.
Well, from whoever. So isn't it fair to say that... although Reserves in the big picture hasn't been fully compensated, at least with respect to these particular costs and expenses, they have been repaid those through the other payment that they received, not from Esham.
Well, I think there are two separate obligations. There's a Severn equitable obligation to pay out of the construction trust to reimburse Reserve for certain costs. But there's also the tort damages that have been calculated, which is a separate amount, a separate payment obligation that Esham owes individually, separate and apart from any obligation that Severn may have to pay out of the construction trust. I think they're two separate things.
Well, I understand that a tort is not the same as a contract, but if the damages are based upon contractual losses, why is it that they're different in terms of seeking this recovery?
Well, I think he happened to use the same numbers. I don't think that makes them the same dollar, the same obligation. I think the method of calculating those damages that Judge Stokes used, he looked to the invoices that Reserves paid and that Reserves was damaged, and those are the numbers he used to calculate this separate obligation and the separate payment that Esham is required to make.
Well, let me follow up on that. Your client's damage claim had a number of different elements, which we can call A, B, C, through Z. elements amount to the $152,000.
Yes, Your Honor.
Those elements were recovered through the sovereign payment. Is that correct?
Those amounts were recovered, yes.
So as to that, if your client were to recover that amount a second time, there would be a double recovery.
It would be the recovery of the amounts, but I don't think it's the same obligation, Your Honor.
It would be you're claiming the same amount of dollars and the same elements, aren't you?
Yes, but the same invoices were used to calculate both of the.
All right. So, you know, on the bigger question of what's at stake here, you can't argue that you're not seeking a double recovery, at least as to those elements. What you're arguing is that there's nothing unjust about it because you were not compensated for other losses, that is, for other elements of your claim. Would that be a fair statement?
I think the method of calculating the damages are...
Would that be a fair statement?
I suppose so, yes, Your Honor.
All right, one other question. Legal foundation of your position is that res judicata was a defense. It should have been raised before Judge Stokes. Certainly at an earlier stage of the proceedings when the facts were known to the other side.
Yes, sir.
Suppose that defense had been raised in a timely way. What would have been the result? That would have foreclosed you, would it not?
I think if Judge Stokes would have agreed with Esham that he had already his liability had already been satisfied, then he probably would not have found personal liability on Esham's behalf. That would have
if he had upheld the defense of payment, then he would have not.
If he upheld
then
he
wouldn't
defense.
Have this claim.
If he upheld the defense, I believe that would right. end his analysis.
And would there be any basis for him not to uphold the defense?
Well, we think if res judicata fails, the collateral source rule would bar that payment from counting against Esham's personal liability.
So you would have argued that the collateral source rule would preclude that defense?
Yes, Ron. That's what we would have argued below, yes. If it was
Tell me your theory of how all of this would have gotten into the record, and because the remand to Judge Stokes was from this court with jurisdiction retained. And what our court basically said is you've made a decision, but we'd like you to explain the personal liability of the individuals. So we were basically taking him back to the original judgment that was appealed. That all preceded payment by anyone. Normally, when you take an appeal, the record's closed, and you make a determination based on that record. To go forward with this defense, you would have had to have somehow expanded the record or get our court to agree that the record could be expanded. You simply can't come in and say, what was the original personal liability of these individuals? And then at the same time say, all right, now that we know these individuals should have been personally liable, why don't we look at what transpired after this, including the payment, and conclude that notwithstanding their individual determination of liability, it's been extinguished because of past acts. Wouldn't someone have to consult our court or make an application to Judge Stokes before you just expanded the record on remand?
Yes, Your Honor. On remand, Esham should have petitioned the court to reopen the evidence. The payment from Severn happened in April 2008. That was after the trial occurred in August of 2007. So Esham, you're right, Esham would have had to apply to Judge Stokes, ask him to reopen the evidence to present this new evidence. Judge Stokes would have then had the discretion to reopen to hear this.
But Esham's position is And we have two separate issues. What was the original liability of the individuals? That's the purpose of the remand. And Judge Stokes has said, you know, I'm looking at this on remand. I conclude they're personally liable. Here's the amount they're personally liable for. And what Esham's saying in this appeal is that that was totally consistent with the purpose of the remand, but now it's entirely proper for him to bring a second action to have the judgment satisfied, which is what Judge Graves ruled on, and that there's no problem with the fact that he didn't require the record to be expanded because he wasn't mandated to do that.
I think in the interest of judicial efficiency, judicial economy, the defense should have been raised on remand in front of Judge Stokes to hear the entire issue of whether personal liability exists and whether it's owed all in the same courtroom rather than have multiple proceedings to find the liability, appeal that, start a new proceeding with Judge Graves, go through that, and now we're back here again to hear this issue again. He was better off, and he should have reopened the motion to reopen the record, present all that evidence at the same time so Judge Stokes could have made a complete determination without wasting judicial resources.
Well, on remand, you would have hoped that Judge Stokes would have come up with a number greater than $152,000, wouldn't you?
Yes, Your Honor.
So that's one of the other issues here. If we had at least $600,000 in controversy, we ought to at least first find out whether anybody owes anything. And then once that determination is made, see what's been paid in a subsequent proceeding. Isn't that why we're here now, because that's the way it proceeded?
That is the way it proceeded, yes.
Do you want to say anything about your collateral source argument?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe the res judicata would be an absolute bar to Esham's claim and forecloses further arguments on the merits. We would also argue that Esham's petition is also barred by the collateral source rule. The collateral source rule would bar Esham from using payment from Seven, an independent source, as an excuse to evade his personal responsibility to compensate reserves for his tort damages. Severn's obligation to pay reserves from the construction trust is independent from Esham's obligation to compensate reserves for the damages caused by his tort. Reserves paid for the right to be reimbursed for its cost by Severn out of the construction trust. Reserves bore all of the risk up front in this arrangement by paying the infrastructure costs and getting relying on Bellavia to reimburse it from the construction trust. Severn funded the trust with proceeds from a loan taken out by Bellavia. Esham himself paid nothing. If at a later date Esham promised to personally guarantee Bellavia's loan from Severn, that's a separate after-the-fact arrangement that has nothing to do with Reserve's right to receive payment from Severn out of the construction trust.
Well, tell me if this is a fair reading of Judge Stokes' determination on remand, or if it's not, tell me where you disagree. He concluded that Esham committed fraud, and yes, as a result of the fraud, Esham should be jointly and severally liable for a certain amount of money. And that coincided with what we've talked about, how he determined that from the invoices. Wasn't he in essence saying, but for your fraud, this money would not have been advanced, the balance would not be owed. So therefore, because of your fraud, you're jointly and severally liable to see that the money in those invoices gets repaid in full.
I believe that's accurate, Your Honor.
So if they're jointly and severally liable to see that the money in those invoices gets repaid in full, and they have been repaid in full, why does Esham still owe money?
Because we think that's a separate, the tort damages that he incurred or he caused is a separate obligation from Severn's equitable obligation found by the Chancery Court to reimburse for costs out of the construction trust.
Right, and that's the purpose of my question. How do you get to that? If we could find that in the record, it would be very helpful. but if a fair reading of Judge Stokes' opinion is you're jointly and severally liable for the amounts owed in these invoices because those amounts would not have been incurred but for your fraud. They're tying the fraud and the joint and several liability to the amount in the invoices. And your answer is, no, it's really separate. Tell me where we find that in the record.
I can't point to that, Your Honor.
All right. You wanted to reserve 5 minutes. You have 4.5. Do you want to reserve that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Burrell.
Good morning, Your Honor. Justices, Richard Burrell for the appellee in this matter. Let me start with something that Justice Holland asked. I think that was a good jumping off point. And it had to do with the record that had actually been created below. And I think that's important because I think that's exactly what Judge Graves ruled implicitly in his decision. What Judge Stokes heard in July of 2007 became the record in this case, and it remained the record in this case from that day forward. It was that record that Reserves appealed to this court the first time around, or I guess that was the second appeal, and it was that record that this court remanded back to Judge Stokes with a fairly specific and fairly narrow question. The record never changed throughout the process. The remand notice that Judge Steele actually signed seemed very specific and raised the issue of whether Reserves had fairly presented a particular argument to this court or had fairly presented an argument at trial that he was raising on appeal. And he asked the trial judge to fully address whether or not that had occurred. Certainly that was not a direction to go back and take new evidence or to expand the record. And although I understand that a trial judge probably has that discretion inherently, there was certainly no suggestion that he go back and open up the entire case to take new evidence and raise new arguments. And Judge Stokes, I think, treated it in that same fashion and included in his opinion or his decision on remand that there would be supplemental findings of fact and conclusions of law, and they will address only the arguments that were presented at trial. I think throughout this case, Judge Stokes has treated very narrowly the record that was before him and tried very hard to stick with that record on remand to the point of taking Reserves to task a little bit for trying to raise arguments that were outside of that record.
Mr. Burrell, what was the total amount of the judgment entered in favor of Reserves?
At the original trial, Your Honor?
In the, you know, as we sit here.
The total judgment was roughly $604,000, plus there was a component for attorney's fees added onto that.
All right. And was that all paid?
No, sir. The Chancery Court decision, which was rendered in November of 2007, required that Severn Savings Bank from Annapolis transfer roughly $330,000 of Bella Via's money to Reserves, which it did. And following up on a question that you asked, Your Honor, it was item specific. I mean, it was items A through F or however many that the Vice Chancellor noted. And Judge Stokes's decision on remand was specific as well as to the first two of those items. And to kind of go back to where Justice Berger started.
The balance that is the difference between $604,000 plus or minus and the $330,000 plus or minus remains unpaid?
Correct.
Let me follow up on that. Your client was found to have committed fraud.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the trial court identified certain specific damages that, but for the fraud, would not have been incurred, and found that your client was personally liable for that amount. If I understand Reserve's argument correctly, what they're saying is, yes, it was the same amount as these two components, the bond money and the other thing that I've forgotten. But a fraud is different than contract damages. And if somebody commits fraud and the person against whom or the company against whom it's committed has not been made whole for all of its losses, why do you get to be absolved and get a satisfaction of payment when reserves has not satisfied its judgment and there is a judgment against your client that says you owe $152,000 or whatever?
I think, Your Honor, that the way in which Justice Holland fashioned his question earlier is precisely the way it worked. Judge Stokes found that but for the fraud that was committed, two specific items would have been paid by Bella Via early on, the bond cost and I think it was a down payment to a general contractor. But in fact, those items did end up getting paid through the transfer by Severn of Bella Via's other money. So in fact, it was not so much a general finding of fraud as much as it was, I'd almost make it analogous to making Esham a personal guarantor of items A and B. If for some reason
I understand that you would rather not have the label fraud attached to your client's conduct, but that is what the court found. And if you commit a fraud, it seems to me it's one thing to say, here are some expenses that wouldn't have been incurred but for your fraud. And that's what I'm going to make you personally responsible for. I don't know that that necessarily translates into, and if somebody else has paid those amounts, you're off the hook, even though the overall judgment has not been satisfied.
I think had Judge Stokes intended to make the damages against Esham, the personal damages, go beyond those two specific items, he would very easily have said that.
You're saying that Esham was not, there was no judgment against Esham for more than the $152,000?
Well, that's absolutely true.
That is, the unpaid amount, the amount that's currently unpaid is owed by someone else.
Well, the judgment that, the overall judgment, the $600,000 judgment that Reserves has is against Bella Via LLC. The judge basically said that Esham made a promise that these two specific items would be paid by Bella Via when he intended not for that not to happen. And that didn't take into account things which came up after those two specific items were due early on. The Judge Stokes made that finding very specific as to just that one promise to make those two payments.
Let me try to ask it a different way. There was a judgment of roughly $604,000 against whom was that judgment entered, and in what amounts?
That was a judgment, a general judgment against Bella Via LLC in favor of Reserves.
That the entire
$604,000.
All right. And then there was a separate judgment.
Then there was
jointly and severally against Esham and the other gentleman whose name I can't.
Elboyne. There was a second judgment against those two individuals for, again, items, I'll call them A and B because there were two specific items.
Well, Mr. Burrell, remind me what the record reflects on how the determination was made that items A and B, as you're calling them, would be paid. We have a situation where we have a $600,000 judgment, $300,000 is going to be paid. And sticking with these simple examples, you could pay items A through F, which would be six. The question is, what are we going to do with this $300,000? Are we going to pay D, E, and F? Are we going to pay C and D? Are we going to pay A and B? As it turns out, using these examples, A and B were paid, which now Esham is saying was good news for him. How was the determination made to use the $300,000 to pay A and B?
If the court were to review Vice Chancellor Parsons' decision, the November 07 decision, that's the way he couched his decision. I mean, that's the way he laid it out. in terms of...
Well, that's what I was saying. Remind me what the record reflects. So this determination is what we will find if we go back to Vice Chancellor Parsons' decision.
Absolutely. He specifically addressed, again, items A through F, or however many there were in his decision, and two of the, and they were all early on in the process, because he found, based on some promissory estoppel and unjust enrichment, that Reserves was entitled to obtain from the construction trust several of the early expenses, and that totaled the $330,000 or so.
So the point of the question is, from your client's perspective, we had an independent judicial determination that A and B should be paid from the trust. It wasn't simply a question of individuals allocating the money to A through F however they wanted to do it.
No, that's absolutely correct, Your Honor, and you will find them at identified at A69-70 in the record. That correlates to pages 48 and 49 of Vice Chancellor Parsons' decision, in which he lays out exactly what sums were due. Unfortunately, he used numbers instead of the letters I've been using, but he laid out seven specific items that totaled $316,000, and the first two, one and two, were the same as those which Judge Stokes used in his decision on remand.
But still, the items that totaled the $300,000-some-odd did not address the full damages. It was just, here's how much of the damages you can recover from the construction trust, which is the only thing that had any money in it, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so that being the case, there is, $300,000-plus that is Bella Villa's responsibility, but it's no longer in existence, right?
The Bella Villa is no longer in existence. It's essential. It exists as a shell.
Okay. But what I'm getting at is that, having made a determination that the prevailing party can recover a certain amount of its damages from one particular defendant that has funds to pay, and identifying which funds those could be or what they represented, you're trying to hang on to that as being the reason why your client's particular responsibility has been paid. But in light of the fact that the full amount of the judgment has not been paid, just because that was identified in the court's decision, that only means that the court decided this solvent party is going to be responsible for this payment. It doesn't mean that your client, who committed fraud, has no more responsibilities, does it?
Well, I think in this instance it does, Your Honor. If you recall, Reserves on remand sought from the individual members of the LLC far more than what Judge Stokes had originally entered as a judgment initially. Judge Stokes could have found that the either Esham or Elboim or all four were personally liable for the entire debt, in which I would agree then that they would still be on the hook for the remaining $300 plus or minus over and above what Severn had advanced. But I think the way the judge fashioned his decision and made it specific as to those two items, because of the point in time at which the broken promises were made, it appears to me from a reading of his decision that he made it clear that Elboim and Esham were to be responsible only for those two items, not for the entire judgment.
Well, tell me why, and this is how I understand your opponent's argument, and you tell me where it breaks down. The court determined that your clients committed fraud, and they should be liable for $152,000 of the Bella Villa debt. Your opponent says the only relevance of those invoices is the measure of damages. But once damages were measured, we're really talking about their liability for $152,000 of the total debt. So going back to Justice Berger's question, if the two invoices were simply a measure of damages, and after damages were measured, there was a disconnect, so to speak, then if you have a $600,000 judgment and $300,000 has been paid, and Esham is jointly and severally liable for $152,000, they're saying we can collect the $152,000 because $300,000 of our judgment remains unpaid. So I know you want to connect the liability of Esham to the invoices, but your opponent is saying they're disconnected. It was simply a measure of damages, and Esham was jointly and severally liable for $152,000 of the $600,000.
And I don't agree with the way that Reserves has phrased the argument. And again, I'll go back to the record and the testimony in the, before Judge Stokes, Your Honor, in which Judge Stokes focused on this period of time, this one promise that had been made by the two individuals as to the payment of two specific invoices, and found that that was the promise that was breached. Then it got to the point where the finding, I believe, was something to the effect that at that point, Reserve should have known that there were problems and should have been more careful. But the record itself and the way the judge wrote the decision supports the position that we're taking, that the only promise that was broken was one dealing with two specific items, and those were the two items for which he made the two individuals personally responsible. He did not say that as a result of your fraud, you're on the hook for whatever Reserves ends up proving or approved previously in the way of $600,000+. He was very specific about that time.
Mr. Burrell, yes. Because your time is running short, could you address the collateral source rule argument?
Thank you. I will do that and try to be very brief with that, Your Honor. Throughout the briefing, you have seen that Reserves attempted on the one hand to try to convince the court that it had established the benefit, that it had established the fund from which the $300,000 payment was made. And I would suggest to you that that's just simply not correct. The fund that was created was a matter of lender and borrower. It was no different than if anybody else went out to borrow money to have a house built. The contractor, as a general rule, has no rights to those funds. They didn't create it. In this case, Reserves didn't pay into it, didn't buy it as a policy of insurance, for example, like an underinsured motorist policy or something to that effect. And in fact, we've been down this road because in the Chancery Court proceeding, Reserves attempted to achieve some status as a third-party beneficiary in that fund. And again, Vice Chancellor Parsons rejected that out of hand. And again, you can find that in his decision at page A65. So on the one hand, there is simply no basis for Reserves to claim that they paid for or suffered a detriment or that the fund somehow was created by them. On the other side of the coin, as Judge Graves found, there was a connection between Esham and Bella Via and that construction fund. And that stems from the construction loan agreement that the LLC and the individuals had with Severn Savings. The original mortgage was something in the neighborhood of $4.5 million, some of which was used to buy the property, and the rest was set aside for future construction. That was a fund that was created by Esham and his partners in Bella Via for further use. And that connection is there, which should allow the tortfeasor, in this case, to gain credits for money that fund has actually paid to Reserves. In this case, as Judge Graves found, the Bella Via borrowed the money. The individuals personally guaranteed it. And, in fact, in this instance, Esham ended up having to make good on that guarantee at some point. But it works just the opposite of the way that Reserves has portrayed it. It had no interest or no role in establishing the fund on the first hand, and then on the second prong, Judge Graves was correct that there is that connection between Esham and Elboim and the fund, which takes that, I guess you say, it takes it out of the collateral source rule principles. I guess I have a couple minutes left. Let me just jump back to one issue, and I think someone said, well, suppose Judge Stokes had actually considered res judicata at some point during the process, and I think very clearly an analysis of the elements of res judicata with what had happened would have dictated that it would have made no difference whatsoever.
Considered the defense of payment.
Payment. The fact of the matter is the 2115 under Title 25 is not a collateral attack on an underlying judgment. What Judge Stokes had was an issue dealing with personal liability where that was fully litigated. But 2115 is the procedure for satisfying a judgment, and there was nothing about the underlying petition or action that went back and tried to attack the existence of that judgment.
That may be. Your client may have a right under a statute to obtain a satisfaction, but a statutory right, like any other right, can be precluded if the doctrine of res judicata bars the assertion of that right. So, there's no escape. I don't think the fact that Section 2115 exists is an answer to the res judicata argument.
Well, I think the argument is that there was no similarity of claims between the underlying action that Judge Graves considered and the action before Judge Stokes. There was only one action in which personal liability was litigated, and that was not the case in the petition that was filed that led to this appeal.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And did I correctly characterize your argument that the 152 and the two invoices were simply a measure of damages, and that once damages were measured, Esham was liable for 152 against the total of 600,000?
Yes, Your Honor. I think Justice Holland articulated our position that if Judge Stokes may have awarded damages differently, such as unpaid attorney's fees, if he had the chance. To sum up, we believe that res judicata bars Eshman's petition, and we believe it should have been rejected at the court below. That's all I have.
Thank you. Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement and will also take a recess.